I was gonna ask when you were telling that story. I was like, but isn't Bryn like short for something? Like, I remember you.
I was literally yes, it is. It's short for Bryn Burley.
Because I remember you telling me that. I remember you told me that with the straightest face. Like, you did not say, just get, like, it was just like, and I was like, oh, that's really pretty, actually.
I know. And that's what everyone says. They're like, that's so different. And I'm like, yeah, I never tell people that because it's just like, it's embarrassing.
I think that's what you said to me.
I'm like, yeah, I don't really tell people that it's Bryn Burley for long, you know, because like, because like, people get weird about it. And like, you know, I just prefer Bryn because it's like normal.
That's crazy.
They don't have it on like keychains. No.
Bryn Burley. That's why I auditioned for like Christmas at Pemberley because I saw myself in
Christmas
it.
Christmas at Bryn Burley. Yeah.
Christmas at Bryn Burley. Today.
Okay, so we're talking about Shakespeare today because I don't think we've talked about Shakespeare yet on the pod, have we?
No, we haven't.
We genuinely have not.
And that he's like the, you know, the dude.
He's the guy.
Of literature.
He's the man. Crème.
And like, if we're talking about people crème. Who... The what? Crème de la crème?
The crème de la crème.
He's the crème fraîche, sure. We'll say. He's, yeah. Anyways.
But when we're talking about people... like, we're... HelloFresh, sponsored by Shakespeare. The creme de la creme.
HelloFresh.
No, but, okay.
Sponsored by Shakespeare.
When we're talking about people who don't know anything about literature,
yeah.
The person they think of
is
Shakespeare.
Shakespeare.
So we felt it was only fitting to mm-hmm. have our theater friend,
mm-hmm.
you know, baddie,
yeah.
lover girl.
Yeah.
Barista babe on the pod. Could you
lover
introduce
girl.
Yourself?
I can't get over lover girl. That's really
lover.
It's true.
Theater girl baddie. Theater friend baddie lover girl.
Barista.
That's me. Put that on a keychain.
Extraordinaire.
You'll find that on a keychain before you'll find Bryn Burley.
So yeah, true. I actually did last Thursday at a gas station. Oh. I'm just kidding.
In the lab, you know. In the anti hall.
Yes. Hi. Thanks for having me. Mm. My name is Bryn Neuenhaus or Neuenhuis. You decide. I actually don't know which one's more Dutch.
Oh.
But whichever one is more Dutch, say that one.
Yeah.
Okay, true. My mm-hmm. two, I have two little cousins. They're both 12. When they were like 7, they got in an actual argument, like tears, because they thought they had different last names and they weren't related because one of them pronounced it Neuenhaus and one of them pronounced it Neuenhuis.
Oh my God.
And these two children were like panicked thinking that their like best friend cousin was not related to
oh
them.
Oh my God.
But they are. They are related. Spoiler.
I thought they were siblings and somehow they like went their whole lives pronouncing their last names differently. And I was like, how did they do that?
Anyways,
apparently.
Yes. I'm Bryn. I am a recent graduate of Biola University's theater program.
Ooh.
And yeah, Shakespeare, he's the guy. Even though a lot of his stuff is suspiciously influenced by a lot of Italian playwrights.
Okay.
Greek playwrights,
I
French playwrights.
I listened to a podcast about this.
Mm-hmm.
About, like, how there's this whole conspiracy theory that, like, Shakespeare is just a pen name for a bunch of other playwrights.
Yeah.
That's wild. But apparently, I think that there's no way to prove it either way.
Yeah.
Which is wild to me.
Exactly. It's just a bunch of little guys in a trench coat. No, but people did think it was just a group of writers
mm-hmm.
That all just worked together under the same name.
Right. Because he has like a massive body of genius work.
Yeah.
Like every single play you can just like dissect all day long
mm-hmm.
and get something new out of it.
Mastered the form, iambic pentameter.
Mm-hmm.
Which is so hard to write in. I took a poetry class and we had to write a poem in iambic and mm-hmm. I was like,
no.
For like 10 lines.
No,
like,
I can't be bothered.
And this
I
is
can't
like,
be bothered
like characters, they're speaking it out loud.
Yep.
Like, the dialogue has to be motivated. It has to make sense. It's just crazy.
Yeah.
It's absolutely insane. Yeah,
making it make sense is the hardest part.
Make it make sense.
No, genuinely. Jeez. Okay, yeah, because when we read these for Tori, they were like, don't just try to raw dog Shakespeare.
What? Mm-hmm.
They're so like, true.
In no, general, literally. But
put that on a t-shirt.
They were like, you need to watch the play while you read the book. Mm. And that helped me a lot. But even then, like, the iambic, like, all of it is crazy. Mm. Even with all of that, like, I have to go Google the characters mm-hmm. after I read because I'm like, wait, what's going on?
Shmoop.
Yeah. Yep. I read Othello in high school. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I was passionate. There's one right. particular moment where I was like, this woman is confessing. She's great. I don't even remember the character's name, but I just remember I was like, I love literature.
Yeah.
And I was just, I was moved.
Huzzah!
Yes. Huzzah!
What's that movie with Heath Ledger?
A Knight's Tale?
Yeah.
I love A Knight's Tale.
I was just
transported. I don't think I've ever watched that. What is it based on? Is it based on a...
It's based on A Knight's Tale.
No, I don't think it's based on anything.
Oh.
It's such a good movie. You have been weighed. You've been measured.
I have not seen it in so long.
Never mind. I won't finish the quote then. You'll have to watch it.
See, I probably shouldn't reference something that I can't like quote by like I don't know the screenplay like word by word.
Oh, well, that's all I do.
No, it's true.
It is true.
It's true.
That's true. References out the wazoo.
Okay.
Bryn, you pulled out your book.
I yeah, like you pulled out your book. Say. So we're like talking about Shakespeare today. What's funny is we were like, we're going to do Romeo and Juliet. And I was like, yeah, guys, that's a great idea. And then I was like, wait, I've never even read Romeo and Juliet.
In general? Not even
no,
in high school?
No, wow. Not even in high school. That's like, surprising. I've never read it. And so then I was like, well, that doesn't really work. Does it?
No.
So I was like, let's do King Lear. But then that's like the one Shakespeare that Bryn
hasn't read.
And I even like had to do like an hour of research and prep for this podcast because I haven't read King Lear since sophomore year of college. That's crazy. Anyways.
So we're basically like in general, we're going to talk about King Lear a lot. Yeah. But we're talking about Shakespeare in general.
Yeah.
The dude, the man.
The guy.
Bryn
Anne
has
Hathaway.
Her. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Bryn His has wife. Her Norton.
Anthology.
Norton's Anthology of Drama, shorter second edition. Shorter, and it weighs 10 billion pounds and has almost 2,000 pages.
What? She's also like bookmarked up.
It's like, I don't know if you can hear this, but it's like Bible paper.
I was going to say, that's Bible.
Yeah, that
texture.
Is thin.
That's Bible.
I'm trying to see if it has literally anything about King Lear in here. Carry on. I'll look while you guys.
Yeah.
Discuss.
Yeah. So when you were tell us about King Lear. Have never read King Lear before. I don't know anything about it. So give me the rundown.
Well, okay. So I did a little bit of background research on King Lear, but also it just kind of like talks about Shakespeare as a whole. He's big on political commentary, but like also gets into nitty-gritty of psychology, which is so genius because he's talking about how these like little machinations, is that the word right? Mm-hmm. That's the right word.
Yeah.
Yeah. Of like human psychology and interpersonal relationships affect like a whole nation. Mm. And King Lear is like such a prime example of that. And it is recognized as one of his best works for that reason.
Really? I didn't know King Lear was recognized as one of his best works.
According to, I think it was like Columbia University, they were like, yeah, King Lear is like one of the best.
Wow.
And honestly, like, I haven't read all of Shakespeare. Like, I've read Hamlet. I've read Henry IV and the Fifth. And, like, I've read a few others. I read Macbeth. Mm-hmm. You know, I think King Lear was the most...
Oh, I've read Macbeth, too.
Have you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry we're saying this around a theater person.
Yeah, I'm like, guys?
She's like, I'm going to have to perform some sort of ritual to cleanse this space.
We're going to have to play Zip Zap Zop right now for 10
no,
minutes.
No, literally.
Someone bunny.
Emily's like, what's going on?
We're actually going to have to embody an animal and crawl around on the floor.
What? Emily's outnumbered right now. She's the only non-theater person in this room.
Well, that's what makes this episode so cool is because I actually, like, I know historical context and I know how it, like,
plays into like literature as a whole and like the revolution
you're
of
like
society.
I know the practical skills, you guys have the soft skills.
No, I genuinely don't know what's happening until Bryn is like, oh yeah, like I've like memorized Shakespeare before and
she and says, this you need is, a monologue.
Yeah. I know how to do monologue. You? Have you? Wait.
I'm just kidding. I'm kidding.
What did you just
say? I said, do you need a monologue?
Yes.
I have bookmarks in here.
You're like, these are my headshots.
Some good ones from Twelfth Night. There's a part in Twelfth Night where Viola has this aha moment of like, shoot, this girl really thinks I'm my brother and is actually in love with me. And she just confessed it to me. And she's in deep, guys.
She's down bad.
She literally can't tell anyone. It's great. I almost did that monologue for auditions last year.
Oh, for Into the Woods? Genius. Or for Philo Backstage in general.
Philo Backstage in general, but yeah. I chose a different one from Wild Honey by Henrik Ibsen.
Sick. I forget which monologue I did.
Cool.
It's something.
I really like that monologue.
Wow.
Wait, is that Ibsen? I can't remember, guys. Sorry.
Well, you got casted.
Woo! I did do the Sweet Surrender.
She was the Sweet Surrender.
She was the Sweet Surrender. You know what else
I
was?
I was
just
Sweet Surrender. Oh, what?
Should we tell him? You were my orientation leader.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. How have we not talked about that?
I don't know how we haven't talked about this because I was genuinely so embarrassed the other night when Bryn, I have like talked to Bryn, like at least, like I talk to you all the time, like for Chimes things, like I'd cover what you're literally doing.
She's and looking then, at all their emails.
Yeah. And then I, like my freshman year, I did not go to orientation because I was too busy doing Torientation. Yes, that's literally what it's called. And Bryn was my orientation leader that I ghosted. That I ghosted. And she was like, true. Do you remember? I was your orientation leader. And I was like, what?
And here you are.
And here you are
using
now.
Her for content after you've already ghosted her and she brings you snacks.
I know. Bryn is like actually just repaying kindness for my absolute inability
to kill him with kindness, to quote the Selena Gomez.
No, genuinely. So, and then, but the worst part was I didn't remember until you told me. Like, that is just so embarrassing for me.
That is very embarrassing for you.
Awful.
Literally so excited.
Yeah.
I remember she's pulling up the sit. I had like an office job that summer before that year, and it was an office job for a condo rental place. And I would sit in the office because like people would just like check in the morning or check out in the afternoon, but in the meantime I'm sitting there and they were like, yeah, do homework. And I was like, hey, it's June. I don't have homework. So I would carefully curate these emails and I would put like so much like an embarrassing amount of time into these emails.
I love
and, like,
that.
Like personalize them to like everyone, and I would like I would spend so much time and like formatting, making sure it looked good on browser and on mobile. Like absolutely.
Wow.
And I got so excited, and I remember seeing Emily's name on my list and being like, "Oh, her name's like coffee like the drink."
Crazy.
And then I remember her not responding to me. But it's okay. It's okay.
Well, you've been like, actually, this is you've been trying. You've been like, oh, I was rejected by her all these years.
Right.
I've been trying this all four years to get her to love me.
This
and now
was my plan all along. You fell into my trap.
No, it's funny because I was so intimidated by you when I first met you, like in the context of like rich kids and like theater and stuff. Because I was like,
oh yeah,
oh my
gosh,
Bryn is so cool. She's so funny.
Bryn
and I
is the president of
she'll
improv.
Just never, she'll, she's literally so cool. And I just don't think that she'll ever like me. And then you're like, I was your orientation leader. Remember when you ghosted me? And I was like,
no.
I don't feel like, did I say that though? Because I don't feel like
no,
I was.
No, you weren't. You
I
weren't like that.
I never make someone feel bad.
No. This was not your fault. This was me being like, oh my gosh.
You probably were just saying, ha ha. And then,
yeah.
Like,
I'm
like,
do you remember that?
You ghosted me.
I do. It's fine if you don't. I wouldn't remember me either.
Well.
But yeah.
No,
that's so funny.
I think during orientation, I was like fervently reading the Iliad. Because it was due the next week,
is
and
that
I
how
had
you
listened.
Say it?
Yeah, I don't know. Oh. Yes.
I thought it was the Iliad.
Iliad. Some people say Iliad. Some people say Iliad. Anyways, I listened to the 40-hour, this is such an L, I listened to the 40-hour audiobook over the summer.
That's a full-time job.
It was crazy. I get there, I'm in orientation, I'm in one of the orientation lectures, and they're like, hey girl, you can't listen to the audiobook and count it as reading. And I was like, oh no. And so for like all of like Biola orientation, it was sleeping to get like to compensate for the lack of sleep I got during orientation, and reading the Iliad in the quiet room, which was like, you know what, kind
great
of a
way
bad
to start it off.
Yeah, bad way to start the college experience, but it's fine.
You're like, how'd you start your college experience? Well, first I went to an orientation for people who read books, and then I read books in the quiet room in the lower level of the library.
And little did I know how much that would foreshadow the rest of my college experience.
Kind of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, now you're the managing editor of the Chimes.
Which just means I spend all of my time in the Chimes office quietly typing away, making sure that facts are right. And even then, we still get it wrong.
You heard it here first. The Chimes gets it wrong.
We get it wrong sometimes. And
unreliable.
That's okay.
Fake news media.
Oh, fake no. news.
The way that I'm literally having war flashbacks right now.
Oh, no. You're like, no, can you stop? So she's sorry. Wringing her hands. She's like, guys, listen, I'm trying my best.
I have her been in so twitching. Many meetings this semester.
No, yeah. You're doing great, Emily.
Thanks.
We love the work you do.
Yeah.
Bryn, we love the work you do to make us laugh.
Aww. Yeah.
She's the thanks, president guys. Of Rich Kids.
She is, yeah. I she know. Did not include that in her intro. She was like,
I didn't.
Yeah, I'm just a former theater major. And we're like, excuse me, ma'am.
You run the school.
You literally run
please.
The school.
Not true. I wish, though. Who knows what a place this would be if I ran it?
Imagine.
Yeah, but I do. The improv.
I do the improv. The improvement.
I do improvise a little.
A little here.
But yeah, that is something I love. Mm-hmm. Before college, I come from a super, super small hometown. So like theater became this kind of escape, like movies became an escape. And I would watch so much Whose Line Is It Anyway? So much. I thought it was exclusive to the show. I didn't know improvised comedy was an actual thing outside of Whose Line Is It Anyway? Until I got to college. And I was with my freshman year roommate. Shout out Macy. She just got married. Congrats,
crazy.
Queen.
Shout out.
To my friend from high school youth group.
Shout out.
Yeah. What?
Insane.
That's crazy.
But we were like at the CAF, and there was a poster up for improv tryouts, and she was like, oh, that guy on the poster is cute, you should go and see what his deal is.
What?
And I was like, oh, I kind of wanted to go anyways, and I just kind of needed an extra push, like an excuse. And thankfully I recognized somebody there that was already on the team, and so I could talk to somebody. And it, I didn't think I did that well. And I was like, well, that was fun. I didn't know they did Whose Line Is It Anyway. Like, outside of the show.
At Biola.
And oh my then gosh. I got on the team, and the rest is history.
The rest is history.
And there was a senior on the team my freshman year, and he had come back to college. And he's, like, 28. And I was, like, just super unsure of myself and, like, didn't really feel, like, very adequate in the whole deal, and I was like, I don't even know if I'm funny. And then like one of our last shows, he comes up to me, like I did a bit in one of the games, and he like just came up to me and was like, Bryn, you are so funny, like look me in the eyes. And I like started tearing up, and I was like, thanks Torin. And
shout
then I didn't cry, cause I never cry, I'm not a baby. But it's just kind of like things like that. Like, you really never know, like, how your words can affect someone.
That's
like,
so
true. That one comment gave me so much confidence.
Yeah.
And I feel like now, as leadership in the team, it's kind of like a full circle moment. Like, if I can, not that I just am constantly like, hey, you're funny. But, like, if I can genuinely, like, encourage people and affirm people and, like, find their, like, special, like, quirks and like different styles of like their humor and like just kind of validate that because, you know, people want to people want to be what everyone else thinks is funny.
Yeah.
But it's like every single person who's been on the team, is on the team, has something so special that they bring. Mm. And like in life in general. And so just finding those tiny little things to be like, hey, I see that and I love it. It's awesome.
Wow. And you're a great leader.
Yeah, you are.
You're a 10 out of 10.
I appreciate that. I try so hard.
You do, and it shows. Like, when we were like, when we didn't know if you were going to come back, we were like, what are we going to do without Bryn? So, and it's so hard because, like, whenever we have shows and stuff like that, it's so easy to, like, after you do something, you're like, that sucked. I did the thing that I always do.
Oh, man.
But then it's also like, that's why people come because they like to see the things that you always do because that's what you do. Mm-hmm. That's what you're. Mm-hmm. So I think
you're great.
Thanks. And you're also just like you're just really good at what you do, so that's why we're like
Mama Bryn teaches how.
So I took my best friend to one of the Rich Kids shows. Mm-hmm. She lives down in San Diego. And she like we were discussing afterwards and we were walking back and she's like, who's the girl with brown curly hair and blue eyes? I was like, oh, that's Bryn. She's like, she's so funny. Yeah. And I was like, yeah, oh, I know. She is so great. Right.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is so sweet. What's your friend's name?
Serena.
Serena. Hey, girl. Hey, queen. Thank you. Girls supporting girls.
Women supporting women. On women in Women's
History Women's Herstory Month.
Let's go.
Herstory.
Herstory.
It's her story.
And that's what we're here to talk about. Shakespeare.
During Women's King History Month, Weird. We're talking about a historic man.
In a time where women's roles were played by boys.
Great.
Boys.
I mean, I think we're discussing like I think we're discussing Frankenstein at some point, which is a Mary Shelley book.
Mary Shelley.
Good.
Yeah.
We need some women authors up in this lineup.
Emily and Dickinson. True.
Yes. Not in Tory curriculum, but I mean, we could really just.
That's crazy.
Which I used to read Emily Dickinson as a kid, and she was the first person that I read that I was like, oh, I want to start writing poetry too.
Mm-hmm. I went through a very tiny. I don't say I didn't go through an Emily Dickinson phase, but I was on the verge, and I wanted to get into an Emily Dickinson phase, but I didn't. The first poet that I've ever read was Shel Silverstein.
Hmm.
Oh, love Shel Silverstein.
Yeah. I loved him.
Amazing.
I tell everyone around me, but I dressed up as him.
That's crazy.
In fifth grade.
Okay.
Speaking of bald men, Shakespeare was probably bald.
Was probably bald. Okay, so I'm gonna give you like some little notes that I found. Yeah. And then you can talk to us about why Shakespeare is important to you.
Oh.
And then...
Or like
yeah.
Give us the theater... Like, you're going to talk to us about what you've learned, like, in Tory curriculum, yes, about Shakespeare, about King Lear.
Yeah.
And then, Bryn, if you want to talk to us, like, being a theater student, learning about Shakespeare.
Yeah.
How does, like, from that perspective, from that discipline of theater, acting, and we can compare and contrast. I'm being such an interdisciplinary studies major right now.
You are. I love it.
Go off, Emily.
Okay, so, well, King Lear is a tragedy. It's written in the 16th century. It's post-church reform, so society is, like, starting to question patriarchy and specifically patriarchal monarchy, which is just, like, dudes being kings, and it's being passed down.
So not, like, kings, you know, like, literal kings.
Like, literal kings.
But, like, kings being slain.
Yeah. No, but actually... So anyways, society's like, England's just like switching violently between Catholicism and Protestantism.
That's good. Mm-hmm. That's good.
Yeah, they were.
Catholicism and Protestantism. I can't say it.
Protestantism? I've never said that word
before. I don't think I have either. I remember writing this down in my notes and I'm like, I should really practice saying this. So that I don't mess it up on the podcast, and then I just did it. I just messed it up on the podcast.
Between being Catholic and being Protestant,
which is better? Vote in the comments.
Drop a comment down below. Yo, I'm a Catholic. Comment in the poll down below.
Oh my gosh.
I love Martin Luther, man.
I can't recover. Okay. So, okay, here's a quote from Columbia University. Okay, while Elizabeth's accession may have confirmed England as a Protestant nation, so, like, that started happening in the 16th century. In the 17th century, Queen Elizabeth was like, yo, she's the first woman, her straight month, to, like, be the queen, I think. And then she was like, bruh, we're not doing the switcheroo anymore. We're staying with Protestantism.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then, so, okay. The next decades continued to be marked by religious tension. And at the same time, political pressures continued both from outside and within, with anxieties about foreign espionage and expansion and internal treachery and power games. And that is extremely important when we're considering the plot of King Lear, because that's really what's happening, is he's exploring, like, where does this treachery come from? Why is it happening? Let's talk about the dynamics between fathers and sons, especially when there's power involved. We have legitimate and illegitimate sons in this plot, too. So it is really just, like, a commentary on what's happening as a whole in, like, the power dynamics of England. Mm. And then, like, further on down the page from this Columbia University page, shout out Columbia. As its title suggests, King Lear is a play about kingship written during a period when the monarchy was of central importance and the role of the monarch was under constant scrutiny and subject to endless theorization. So this is, like, Shakespeare's attempt at commenting on kingship and, like, royal leadership. So, anyways, that's kind of why King Lear is important. I'll give you, like, a brief summary of the plot. I do have a couple quotes, but we don't have to get into those right now. So basically, we've got our main characters, King Lear. Big surprise.
No way.
Crazy.
Yo, spoiler alert.
King Lear is an old dude. He's, like, ready to pass down his crown to his three daughters, and he wants to split the nation between the three of them. And he decides, like, whichever daughter gives him the best praise, like, wins, like, the biggest portion of the crown.
Oh.
And so two of his daughters, Regan and Goneril. Goneril is also maybe the worst name I've ever heard of for a character in my entire life. And yeah. I just want to put
sounds
that one out
like
there.
Like a certain disease. I was about to just say the disease, but I forgot the name, so I didn't.
Gonorrhea.
There we go. Or gangry.
Gangrene.
Gangrene. Is that how you say it?
Yeah.
Gangrene.
Green.
Anyways, Goneril.
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 Slay queen.
Not yet.
So, okay, what's funny, so both of these two daughters have, like, bad intentions or just, like, are a little entitled, like, very power hungry. And they, like, praise the king. He's like, oh, you guys love me, therefore you get your portion of the crown. And then Cordelia is, like, has no ability to even put into words how much she loves her father. And he takes that the wrong way. And he's like, oh, so you don't love me at all, Ben. And then he's like,
the words of F, King.
Yeah. She doesn't know what to do. He's like, you don't get any power. And then the King of France marries Cordelia.
Oh.
So she's like, okay, that's fine, Dad. I'm just going to go over and rule France instead then. Which is such a power move.
That is a power.
But Cordelia still, like, loves her father, right? Mm. So, anyways. So he splits the kingdom between Goneril and Regan. And King Lear and his 100 companions. He's got 100 friends at his daughter's castle. And he's been there for a while. And Goneril's like, no more. This is actually crazy. This is insane. He does not know how to take that. He's like, gets all offended. He goes to his daughter Regan's castle. This is after everything has been split up. And Regan's like, ain't no way, Dad, that you're taking your 100 friends and you're living at this castle.
Yeah.
And then he's like, okay, then none of my kids love me. And during a storm, wow, he literally goes mad
And this king has issues.
No, he's got problems.
He needs to be affirmed, like, so often.
He needs to be held.
Yeah. By all 100
just need to be held.
All 100 of his friends just need to hold him at the same time.
Let down your guard, king.
Yeah,
Men can cry, king.
Yeah, he's like... anyway, so he's just having a hard time because he doesn't know how to, like, communicate. He doesn't know how to deal with his emotions. He goes mad. Like, he literally goes mad in a storm. He's wandering around in the wilderness.
It's giving Moby Dick vibes.
Yeah, it is. Crazy. That's actually a great connection.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I learned about it from you in our Moby Dick episode.
Crazy.
Actually, plug.
Hey, listen to the Moby Dick episode of Potentia. Catch up.
Sponsored by the Moby Dick episode of Potentia. Sponsored. We put like a couple dollars forward for another episode and this is it.
That's so funny.
Anyways, he goes mad in the wilderness.
He goes mad. Okay, so then this is when subplot really comes into play. So at the same time as all of this ish is going down with his daughters, we have Earl of Gloucester, and he's got an illegitimate son.
Gloucester or Gloucester?
It's spelled G-L-O-U-C-E-S-T-E-R.
Gloucester. I just say that because there's a town in Massachusetts that's Gloucester and it's spelled the same way.
Maybe it's Gloucester.
Yeah, that's like the British like pronunciation of like what we would say Chester is just Esther. So it's like we say like Worcestershire sauce and they just say Worcester sauce. That's
yeah, there's so a town
funny. Like Leicester.
I didn't even realize that. It's spelled the same way. There's a town named Worcester too and it's spelled the same way. It's because, you want to know, I learned about this for my project for my class. It's because, you know, the Northeast, especially like Boston area, they were closer. There was like a whole thing, but also they're closer to Englishmen and seaports. So that's why like...
New England.
Yeah, New England. But that's why like the Boston accent, you drop your R's. Like people will drop their R's because they were closer to English people. So it's like a weird mutation of an English accent.
That's wild.
Isn't that crazy? I'm actually, my midterm project is on how the Northeast has the most like British, is the most quote unquote British of the United States.
Wow.
Which is kind of obvious, but like it's like, oh, the ramifications of that are seated in like the culture of that area and like the accent.
Okay, it's really cool. Wild.
Yeah.
That's crazy. Etymology is so interesting.
So interesting.
So Gloucester?
Gloucester.
Gloucester. I like that better. It's easier to say, too.
It's much easier to say.
Yeah. Okay, Gloucester. So, Earl of Gloucester, illegitimate son, Edmund, and Edgar is his legitimate son. He's got kind of an interesting relationship.
Wait, who's the father here?
Okay, King Lear is one father. Earl of Gloucester is the other father.
Gotcha.
There are two subplots. Okay, or they're both
a different story.
They're both happening, but the two like intersect quite a bit. And they, I guess they could be like considered parallel plot lines. Like it's two different ways. Well, they end up kind of working out the same way, but it's like two different like levels of power being explored.
Gotcha.
Does that make sense?
What does he rule, King Gloucester? Is he a king?
No, he's an earl. And I don't know what that means.
Okay, so his sons.
Yeah. So, like, he has, like, some land. The king owns, like, all the land. Does that make sense? Okay. Sorry. Had to cough. Okay. So, then the earl's son, illegitimate son, is, like, trying to be recognized as a legitimate son. The illegitimate son convinces Gloucester that the legitimate son is trying to kill him in order to, like, get the power that the earl has. So then, like, all of this trickery is going down. Edmund, at the same time, the illegitimate son is, like, well, this is a couple acts later, is trying to get either Regan or Goneril to fall in love with him at the same time. So he's, like, sort of seducing them.
So that's how it interacts.
Yeah. So, like, these three people, like, Edmund, Regan, and Goneril just wreak havoc.
Vibes.
And they're, like, trying to, like... this like they're trying to grab the power from their parents, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
At the like pass down, so when you have multiple siblings,
both of these children are trying to get power from their parents.
Yes,
in different ways.
Yes,
but also through their romance.
Yeah, I mean they're trying to get power from each other.
Yeah,
like they just don't really have the ability to love each other well. Like, they're just trying to get the power from their parents. They're trying to get the power from their siblings. They're trying to, you know.
So a lot of it is about power.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. All of them are trying to play the game. So after the king goes mad in the big storm, Gloucester finds the former king, takes him to a hut, gets him, like, in a place of safety, sort of. And then Gloucester's illegitimate son convinces Regan and Goneril that he is a traitor. And so they literally gouge out his eyes. It's wild. In the play,
Slay Queen.
It's disgusting. It's so gross.
Wait, they actually like...
Well,
wait,
not like...
Oedipus era. They actually do it and then just change out the actors every night?
That would be insane.
A small price to pay for art.
Yeah.
You know, that's why they say break a leg. It's because they want you to get so injured into it on a like a elevated stage that you fall off.
Exactly.
You break your legs.
Exactly.
This is way before unions. They just had theater companies, and it's just which playwright you liked better.
Right.
It was usually Shakespeare or, what's his name? One other guy.
Yeah.
I'll remember.
Yeah.
You'd bodily health,
Maximilian. Not important. Definitely not.
Yeah, definitely not. Anyways, you were saying.
Anyways, okay. So.
So it's all about power.
It's all about power. Okay, so everybody at this point, after Gloucester's eyes get gouged out, they kind of run into each other. Cordelia hears about all of these things that are happening. She, like, sends an army from France to go find her dad. She's, like, absolutely just, like, wrecked over what's happened to her dad and, like, how he's going mad. They, like, run into each other. And then Cordelia is, like, fighting for her father against her two sisters at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a big war. And Regan and Goneril win. Cordelia is executed. King Lear dies from a broken heart.
Is Cordelia one of the daughters or the illegitimate son?
No. Cordelia is one of the daughters.
Okay.
Yeah.
King Lear dies from a broken heart.
Yeah, and then I think the other two sons die as well, but that's, I don't remember for sure. But basically everyone dies, and then there's like two or three people that are left that are like, well, now we have the Kingdom of England to figure out.
Wow, and that's how it ends.
That's how it ends. So it's a tragedy.
Mm.
I feel like a lot of Shakespeare plays are just like, at the end, half the people die.
Oh, yeah. Titus Andronicus.
Mm-hmm.
In Hamlet also.
Yep.
Because Hamlet ends, and the whole thing was just to make sure that King Fortinbras didn't take over Denmark. And then at the end, it's just Hamlet's bestie, and he's like, well, I'm the only one left alive. And now Denmark is King Fortinbras.
Wow. Crazy.
It's the same with the play that shall not be named, right?
Oh, yeah.
Like, everyone is just like...
Oh, yeah. Everyone's dead.
Yep.
Yeah. Everyone is... Do you know about that, Emily?
What one? Which one?
So, Macbeth.
Mackers.
Mm-hmm. Mackers. In theater, it's like you're not supposed to say that name or else it's bad luck.
I did not know that.
Yeah. Inside a theater, though.
Inside
we're
a
fine.
Theater. We're fine here. Macbeth. James Charles isn't going to pop up. Like, we're okay.
Hi, sisters.
You remember Flashback Mary?
Oh, do I ever.
Oh, my gosh. I sent this meme to our roommate group chat about James Charles singing in the middle of a Grand Canyon.
It was just a wide shot of him on a tightrope in the middle of the Grand Canyon singing Hallelujah.
Like, he's, like, there in, like, Lululemon biker shorts, like, in the middle of this, like giant rope bridge.
Yeah.
Have you seen the one of him, like, squatting on the ground? And then, like, he's, like, surrounded by a crowd of, like, it looks like middle schoolers. But he's trying to teach them Bring Me Little Water, Sylvie. I don't know if you guys were in choir, but it's like it's so funny because it's like it's the choral piece is like there's multiple parts and there's physical like percussion and stuff that he's trying to teach them.
Oh my god.
But he's like squatting on the it's like it's so weird. Anyways, but I did that song in high school, so I always thought it was so funny. And he's trying to teach them the harmonies and like he's doing like the arm motions. He's for like you go up,
bring me a little water
to these like 12-year-olds. Yeah, and they're all just like wow.
I think I mean he knows that he was always trying to hard launch his singing career.
Yep.
Oh, yeah,
like
when he was in front of the Morphe store,
yep.
when it was supposed to be like a like opening, grand opening, meet and greet, and then he just starts singing in front of yeah. everyone, and the employees are back like, okay,
girl, we just want that palette,
girl.
We're yeah,
not here for your song.
We, I feel honestly, part of me like feels bad for him.
Well,
that's
he
true.
Did
yeah, he did. He, yeah, he, yes.
Yeah.
I did not know this was going
to
become
minors multiple yeah. times.
That's
even
right.
after he apologized, quote unquote, apologized.
What? Even yeah. after? Oh, I did
nope,
not know
more
that.
People after that were like, hey, he's still doing this.
Nice.
Yeah.
I did not know about that.
Moving on from flashback. Yeah.
So,
anyways.
In, yeah. So, it's very Shakespeare to just kind of like have everybody dead at the end.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of foreshadowing too.
Right.
Because, like, you know, King Lear's ready at the beginning.
Yep.
He's like, it's a new era is beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of you guys. It's kind of like Succession.
Mm. Yes.
You've seen that show?
I haven't, but I've heard
not.
Except King Lear seems a lot nicer than Logan Roy. Anyways, I'll move on from that since you haven't seen it.
Do you like Succession?
I love that show. It's very good. Why?
Should we watch it?
No. I was just wondering.
Oh. You should watch it. Why? What? You guys are...
Wait, what?
Giving weird looks.
I don't know why you looked...
Wait, pause for a second.
Okay, you're going to have to say what you just said again.
So I have taken multiple like theater history courses, and I was looking at my Evernote. Yeah, it's like requirement for the degree or something. but I just like keyword searched Shakespeare, and a theater history note came up about a pamphlet that went around the time King Lear was in performances originally. Written by Leo Tolstoy, and it was
like, it's Leo Tolstoy.
Yeah. That's big,
crazy.
Big,
yeah.
Yeah, big deal. But he published this pamphlet about how he had a very strong distaste for King Lear and thought it was poorly written.
Whoa.
Just not good. And meanwhile, everyone else is raving about it.
That's weird. Crazy.
And so
this is giving Martin Scorsese wrote a whole article about how like the Marvel Cinematic Universe isn't yeah. real film. That's what this is giving.
Yeah.
Like the 1500s version of that.
Yeah. And then guess who eventually made a rebuttal of this pamphlet?
Who?
George Orwell.
What?
What?
Okay, yeah.
I don't even think about how these people live in the same space.
Yeah.
Like that just blows my mind.
Crazy.
I thought George Orwell was so much like younger than that.
Yeah.
I actually don't know.
I think he was. I think he like, just like it, his commentary about Tolstoy's thing was way later.
Okay, that makes so
yeah,
that
yeah,
makes
yeah.
sense.
He wasn't alive
in
the Renaissance, I don't think.
Crazy.
But I mean, a lot of the success from Shakespeare's work came from appealing to royalty, because that was that's the draw for the public, is they were like, oh, we can kind of escape our miserable lives and you know the plague and XYZ thing that was going on during that time period, and you know this new again Renaissance, just like the rebirth of so many different things, and people were so excited to go see theater. And just the way that it was accessible for so many people was just so, so enriching. And a lot of, if you think about Shakespeare's work, so majority of the body of his work, if not all of it somehow, is related to royalty and family drama in
yep.
royalty.
Yeah.
And again, that was like really important. And so some critics like couldn't relate to it.
Yeah.
So they were very critical of it. A lot of other playwrights were still trying to hold on to, again, religious ideals in their work. A lot of theater around that time or just before that time was majorly religious. And they would,
yeah.
that's how they would tell biblical stories in like masses and things like that. And because, you know, some people couldn't read. Mm-hmm. So, you know, seeing a play or hearing like music set to it was like made it accessible for people. And that was like kind of their ministry. They would make these like wagons that they would take around to different cities with like the props and costumes inside these wagons. And it would unfold on one long side into a little stage. And so they would do these like religious plays in these little wagon stages. And so that's what people were used to at the time, was theater was religious. Theater.
So sorry to cut you off. Was this like before the Reformation or during the Reformation or after? Because I just read in my for class yesterday about how there's something called like mystery plays.
Yeah.
Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah. So mystery plays, was how they told Bible stories. They would have a chorus of young men sing and tell the stories. I've seen them and they're very, very long and slow. And again, which made a play with action and violence and scandal so much more, you know, interesting and stimulating to the general public because was, they were so used to just kind of, you know, when you're a kid and you're sitting in church and you're, you know, you all of the words that the pastor is saying is going in one ear and out the other. That's kind of to the point where they were. Yeah. But now it was something so fascinating and full of action.
That's so, I'm sorry I cut you off, but that's so interesting because, like, it was, I just read about this last night because it was about, like, during the Reformation, people were like, hey, people, like, the Reformation's all about how ordinary people should have access to reading scripture. And that's why they put on these mystery plays, because that's how people learned about the Bible, because they didn't have access. It was either through the priest or through these like mystery plays. So that's really interesting. Also, I grew up like doing theater mostly in church. So when I read about that, I was like, that's so funny that this is something that people have been doing since the 1500s. But that's so, that makes so much sense that like they see all these plays that are like really long and might not be that well done. And then you have Shakespeare on the scene and people are getting killed and eyes are getting gouged out and they're like, oh my gosh.
And I mean, same kind of thing goes way back to like the origins of like Greek theater. If you think about like, because people, there has always been this divide, I think, between, you know, some religious group seeing theater as too progressive, or not progressive in like a negative sense, but progressive in this goes against things that we believe. This isn't explicitly religious. And people tried to like outlaw shows that weren't explicitly religious at one point. And there's just always been this tension there. But like Greek plays, you know, you have gods intervening, Deus Ex Machina and that kind of thing. You have like, you know, illegitimate children. You have like Medea, like killing her children at the end. And we're supposed to argue for centuries if she's a hero or not. And like, just all of these things where, you know, the church for such a long time was like trying to hold on to theater. But then just different cycles, of new playwrights who were just kind of pushing the boundaries of what theater could be. But yeah, and that kind of goes like what you were saying, Hannah, but Tolstoy's commentary on it was King Lear wasn't generally accessible and it was just super exaggerated and he didn't like that. And Tolstoy worked really hard to make theater accessible to poor people, especially.
Oh, interesting.
And so that he just had such a strong distaste. He was like, it's just not, it's not well written because, you know, this isn't realistic. It's not. But again, like, what's realistic about, you know, I don't know. What place do you guys?
Anything.
Anything.
Yeah. I mean,
what's realistic about anything?
What is it? What is the play? You know, the seagull.
Yeah.
The I mean, what's realistic about an actress quoting how she's a seagull? I mean, that's just like that. You'd say you could argue any piece of art is either extremely realistic because it's rooted in reflecting the human experience, like even a fantasy, let's say like a fantasy movie. Even if it's like hard fantasy, not of this world, like all this stuff, new creatures, it's still gonna be grounded in relationship to humanity in some sense because it's a human coming up with the concept.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So that's why, like, you can argue fiction is still helpful even when it's not really rooted in reality, because it is always going to inherently reflect humanity because mm-hmm. it's humans making it.
Exactly.
But
yeah.
Yeah.
That's a very good point. And I mean, I just found another note, but after the Renaissance, there was an era of what's called Restoration Theater.
Okay.
And so King Charles I went back and forth. He dissolved Parliament twice. He like dissolved it, put it back, dissolved it again. And then people passed a notion to take away theater because it went against the Puritans' views. And so people started changing the way that they wrote things, like in loopholes.
Mm.
And they were like, okay, well, this doesn't go explicitly against what you said we couldn't do.
Mm.
And so, again, there's that tension. And writing about, like, the upper class and royalty was more of, like, a commentary and, like, almost a sneaky way of, you know, like, sticking it to them.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we have people who are, like, in these plays, like, indecisive, bad people, conniving.
Yeah.
You know, like, murderers. And then it's like, do we sympathize with them?
Mm.
Are we supposed to, like... And there's a whole long argument about yeah. whether or not King Lear is a tragic hero or yeah. not. And, you yeah. know, it's just kind of like this whole debate about what makes someone a hero.
Wow. Mm.
And what, you know...
Yeah.
Like, so...
That, like...
You're saying that Shakespeare wrote Taylor Swift.
Basically.
Anti-hero.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my gosh.
Except he did love the queen.
Yeah, he did. And
they were tight.
Yeah, you bring up a good point when you said like Shakespeare is motivated a lot by royalty.
Mm-hmm.
Which it's like, oh, is that a good thing or a bad thing? Because I'm thinking about this from, like, my discipline as a journalist. Like, oh, like, I have to not have allegiances to power in order to communicate effectively. But what we see in Shakespeare is that he does have those allegiances with power structures. Mm-hmm. And he is communicating very effectively.
Yeah.
That is so interesting to me because he's able to, like, kind of criticize and at the same time tell the story mm-hmm. of royalty in that time. And in doing so, he has, like, a really effective commentary on the society and is also forecasting kind of changes that will happen, like, later on down the road.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. It was simultaneously a humanizing royalty
yeah.
at a time where people, like, the general lower class public was, you know, so against the royalty,
right?
But it was simultaneously humanizing them but also criticizing them,
yeah.
And which is very brave because most of his funding came from royalty, like,
right.
Eventually, like, the whole Globe Theater was funded
yeah.
by
mm-hmm.
royalty, and, like, basically the only reason he got to keep making plays was because he was getting
yeah.
money from the queen.
So, okay, yeah, that's such a good point because King Lear is really, like, criticizing the king or, like, a patriarchal monarchy for the way that it encourages, like, an individual's ego and, like, the way
like
that
the king.
Yeah, the king.
The king's ego.
The king's ego, but also, like, everyone else's ego around them bases themselves on their relation to the person in power.
Mm-hmm.
And so... that's kind of that, like, power dynamic really is what kind of is part of the reason that people have this twisted relationship with each other inside of the royal family, because they're just, like you said, they're just people,
mm-hmm.
you know? And so, like, is King Lear a tragic hero? I would say, oh, no, absolutely not. Like, that would be my personal opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Because I remember in our session on this book, we kind of came to the conclusion that, like, this is such an important book for understanding the relationship between parents and children, and that parents can be just as much at fault as children can be.
Mm. Yeah.
And there are times where the child is actually wiser than the parent.
Yeah.
And
yeah, that's just a really interesting dynamic to me in the context of a monarchy, because right. you have these children who are then not getting the power, as Cordelia is not getting the power because she's doing the right thing. And then you have the people who are power hungry getting the power. Yeah. So he's criticizing King Lear's ego,
mm-hmm.
Because King Lear is giving the power to whoever flatters him the most. And when he can't respect his own children's boundaries, that's when he goes mad, because he thinks that if people aren't at his every whim, then they don't love him.
Mm-hmm.
Which,
and then, yeah.
How else would you think differently if you were in his circumstances?
Right. And you if know? You, that's all you had ever known.
Yeah.
And then it's like he dies of a broken heart, and it's like, well, was it a broken heart because he loved his children so much? Mm. Or is it a broken heart because that's where he found his worth from, you know?
Exactly.
Was
yeah.
what his children thought of him.
And even because, like, he, in the beginning, when he's like, okay, I need to see, I'll split this up based on, like, how you say, like, who loves me the most.
Yeah.
Like, that's not really about the children. Because, like, a definition of love is wanting what's best for another person
mm-hmm.
besides yourself.
And, like, sacrificial and selfless in that way.
Yeah. So, yeah. So when he's like, oh, I want to see who loves me the most, that's not really showing his love for them. It's showing more of an insecurity that he needs externally affirmed. Which is why I also was like, with the 100 friends thing, he's like, this dude's living somewhere else and he needs to take all of these people with him.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
To be affirmed. That's a really interesting point.
Mm-hmm.
Burn.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think Shakespeare handles male egos.
Mm.
In a very creative way,
mm.
because people are, I mean, I am one of them, but there
a male ego?
Yes, I am manic pixie male ego. I mean, there's like the opinion that Shakespeare doesn't write women often, or, you know, like most of his heroes are men, but I mean, looking at the circumstances, you have the inability to cast women in your plays and, you know, it's just boys in makeup and stuff.
Right.
But also, like, you know, you write what you know. And I think he handled, because if you look at Hamlet, his whole deal, he's, you know, so insecure and, like, afraid of being a leader and so afraid of, like, his father's ghost being disappointed in him and someone else leading instead of him, and he's so indecisive about what to do that he's, you know, at his wit's end and that sort of thing.
Hmm.
And then you have King Lear, who's, you know, also insecure in himself as a father,
right,
where it's like that's what he puts it down to, is like, okay, well, who cares about me most? Did I do a good job, you know, kind of thing? And
right.
I feel like that's one way you could look at it, but
yeah, that's true.
There's a lot of, I think the more you look at the male characters, and like Macbeth also, like everyone thinks he's like, oh, the great King Macbeth, but like he is also very insecure.
Yeah.
And like he is really taking everyone else's word as gospel for like what to do. Especially with like Lady Macbeth, she's like, oh, you need to do this because this is this, and he's like, I don't know. And he's like, again, afraid. And I feel like there's just so much fear in Shakespeare.
Wow.
Where it's like,
yeah,
you think it's strength, but it's like, no, actually, if you look at like what is happening situationally. And
yeah.
I also like, it makes me wonder, because I wonder.
The Lorax. Mr. O'Hare.
I wonder.
You don't know me, but my name's Si.
I'm just the O'Hare delivery guy. See, I'll actually get the quotes from that movie. Mm-hmm. I wonder because like the author can have an intention of what they mean, and then we can interpret something based on how we see things in hindsight. Mm. So, like, we interpret that as, like, oh, he's actually kind of insecure and fearful. But I wonder if that was, I wonder what actually Shakespeare's intention was for all these characters.
Yeah.
Because it seems like, there's a lot, we see a lot of similarities of, like, oh, they all seem very fearful and insecure.
Mm.
And it plays off as strength, but it's actually kind of a little bit of an insecurity. And that's also a very, like, actor thing to notice.
The subtext.
The subtext.
The subtext.
The motivation. The objective.
What's my motivation here?
Yeah, you're. It's like very. And but that's also like what we. It's like fun. That's why we like. You know, we dig in and we're like, oh, but he's actually because of his trauma. You know what I mean? But I wonder what, like, I wonder if Shakespeare actually saw it as strength, but I don't know if he would. Like, I wonder if, like, what Shakespeare would say, King Lear, why does he go mad? Does he go mad because of, like, all these external things and it's him? Or is it because of actually King Lear himself?
That's literally, okay, yes, because I think this was like a final question for me, actually, is like, what does Shakespeare think about madness? Mm-hmm. And my high school sophomore English teacher for the 6 months that I went to public high school, Miss Bonanno.
Miss Banana?
Miss Bonanno.
Oh, okay.
Miss
Bonanza.
Bonanno. Explained it to me this way. She's like, Shakespeare thinks that the human mind is like a piece of paper and like bad events are like water. Things that are difficult to handle are like water. Too much water and you begin to deteriorate. And so you see that happen throughout all of Shakespeare's plays where enough bad things happen to one character and they just disintegrate. And so it's a really amazing way of observing human psychology because he's literally talking about trauma. And he's literally talking about what happens when you don't have a place to process that. And so King Lear is specifically interesting in that the circumstances of his madness are partially his own fault. Because he is, like I said, he's not respecting other people's boundaries. He's looking to other people for validation. Man's needs help, you know? Man's like, he needed a better parent.
To quote Bryn, like 30 minutes ago.
He needed to be held.
Yeah.
How to solve all of the world's issues and how to save King Lear.
That's the name of this podcast.
He just wants to be held, or how to solve the world's problems?
Both.
How to solve the world's problems, colon.
He needs to be held. He needs to be held is actually a great name.
Yeah.
But yeah, I do think too, because you look at the comedies even, and a lot of the humor comes from people going crazy and, you know, descending into madness. And, you know, we laugh at it and we joke about it. But again, it is kind of like that.
Yeah.
The paper analogy. Of just like so many bad things. And again, that's kind of what humor originated from, was irony of like just bad things happening to people. And like you spin the tone of a comedy and it's a tragedy because it's just bad things happening to people. And I think that's it, because that's the irony, is that the tone is light despite all of these bad things happening to someone. And that's, you know, again, since Greek theater, that's where humor came from.
Wow. Interesting.
Okay. That's wild. I have two things. One, that's so interesting because, I mean, in general, we know that, like, people laugh at something because it's relatable. That's why, like, Will Ferrell for his SNL audition doing a cat impersonation is funny because it's accurate. It actually looks like a cat. Or like saying a dumb joke about, like, just like you mentioning little details about something, they're like, oh my gosh, that's so true, that does happen. When I do wash my hands, I get
matter with washing your hands? You get the water
on your
where
belly.
Do all the socks go? I do the laundry.
I only have one.
That's my Jerry Seinfeld.
That's great.
Wow.
But like, that's it's relatable, and that's what makes it funny. But then also, so that's what makes me think of that, of like why you're able to spin something light of like someone being really clumsy and getting hurt all the time, people can laugh at in a comedy because it's partially relatable. But then, and maybe because it's like, hi, you're getting hurt, not me, defense mechanism vibes. But the second thing I think of is, I was telling you, Bryn, about, I was talking about everyone on our team, and I was like, it's crazy that like the funniest people I know are also the most deep and reflective and philosophical and smart and intelligent. And we were talking about how a lot of that has to do with like wit, because you have to be kind of like on your toes, especially for improv. You have to be able to know what to say. It takes a lot of intelligence to do that. But also because if there's this kind of connection between suffering and humor,
Wow.
people who've like dealt with suffering
and like really have thought through it can also spin it and make it ironic and humorous.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Comical. So that's such an intuitive connection, bro.
Right. It's just a very lengthy way of that one trope of like, you're so funny. Thanks. It's the trauma.
Literally.
But yeah, there is like history to that, and there is, you know, philosophy to that that dates so far back.
That's crazy. But I've never thought of that before in that way.
Yeah. That is crazy. Yeah. No, wow. That's insane. What does that say about rich kids?
You'll have to find out at our show.
March 30th.
This
probably will come out after March 30th because we have so many.
Yeah, we have so many backlogged episodes.
This is sponsored by the March 30th Rich Kids Show.
So true. And if you went, you know, here's an inside joke that you'll only know if you went to the show on March 30th. guys, he's right behind me, isn't he?
You're gonna wanna see this.
Is that Larry Bird? Okay, that's the inside joke. I'm gonna have to put that in the March 30th show.
You're gonna have to do that bit.
If you did go to the show and that came super out of nowhere, you know why. I am legally bound to saying that at the show because I said it on the podcast.
Keep her accountable if she doesn't say it.
I will remove myself from Rich Kids and I won't be president anymore.
I was about to say you'll press charges, but then I realize against yourself.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You'll stand Bryn against yourself in the court herself. Of law.
I will King Lear. I'll be like, hey guys, all of you make me laugh. Someone else is going to be president. And then you all, Lord of the Flies, kill each other.
And then I'm going to move to someone else's castle and bring all my friends with me.
Yeah, I'm going to a castle because you guys don't love me enough.
Come on, guys.
Come on, guys. Don't you want to live in a castle with me? Is that a storm?
I just think it's funny how many Shakespeare plays, like, there's just, like, all of a sudden Shakespeare's like, what do I do next? And then he's like, add a big storm.
And then he writes... Storm. The Tempest.
And then he writes, yeah, that's exactly
it. And also the beginning of Twelfth Night is a shipwreck.
There you go.
Wow.
But also there's a musical.
Okay.
Called Something Rotten.
Okay.
Oh.
And it's a comedy. Yeah. It's I don't know if I would say flat out satire, but I'll say it's satire. But it's about a playwright named Nick Bottom, who is super jealous of Shakespeare's success. And Shakespeare in this musical is like rock star kind of Mick Jagger vibes of like, wow, I'm the big cheese. And, you know, he's trying to figure out what his next play is. And Nick Bottom goes to a soothsayer to find out. But this is like the nephew of the big popular soothsayer. And so he's like, his next play is called Omelette. And so Nick Bottom writes an omelette musical, and meanwhile Shakespeare is writing Hamlet.
Wow.
But so it is also, there's a lot of commentary on like how people thought Shakespeare was a hack, and like,
oh yeah,
there are other playwrights at the time who like thought they were doing valuable work, but because he was the big name, it's like none of these plays get recognized. Mm. And there's a lot of, I mean, arguably not as well done, but there are a lot of other plays from the Renaissance era that, especially internationally.
Yeah.
A lot of Italian plays from that time period, which, shout out Hannah.
shout out people, dude.
Shout out to Italy.
Shout out to Italy.
Shout out Italy. ciao bello.
Okay.
Wow.
Tell me why you have a great pronunciation.
Thank you.
Anyways,
but yeah, a lot of French plays also in that time period that people don't pay any attention to because people think, oh, 1500s to early 1600s, Shakespeare. And they don't give anything else a chance.
That is so sad.
Yeah.
We do something at the end of the pod.
Okay. Oh, yeah.
Where, unless anyone else said
no. No. Go.
We do something at the end of the pod go.
Hopefully
go.
I said something valuable in this.
Oh, yes.
No, you said so many things
yeah,
valuable.
You, hopefully yeah, you really just sense. Schooled us all. You
no,
just
no, no,
gave
no,
us
no.
a little...
I was going to say which... Okay, first, the end of the pod, we say, like, how do we take this in a personal mm-hmm. application? Usually we end up in something kind of philosophical or theological or whatever. But it's just like, what is... I mean, you've listened to Pretentia.
I have.
You know how it goes.
I love this podcast. If it's not number one on my Spotify Wrapped... I don't know what I'll do.
It's just you listening to your
I
own
will
voice.
Go into a castle with my friends.
You will go into a storm voluntarily and go mad.
Yes, yeah. Yes, 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 yes.
No, but we just like, we're like, oh, what's a personal application you have to your life? Mm-hmm. It could be with something like, you know, very philosophical or whatever. My thing is I'm listening to you guys. You guys were so insightful this podcast. Mm. I appreciate all you guys had to say. I literally am, I think I'm on the brink of a 1500s to 1600s obsession era.
Whoa.
Because
do it, girl.
I think I might, because I realize this about myself. I get into very short obsessions. Like, that's why Arrested Development, Bill Hader era. And then I go straight into, like, Reformation era.
That is
no,
so funny.
No, it's just last night.
Mm-hmm.
I was reading for my studies of grammar and language class about, like, how English became English. And they were talking about how, like, the Reformation, they started printing English Bibles,
mm-hmm.
was, like, all, like, it was ingrained in, because it was going from, oh, only priests can read the Bible, and it mm-hmm. they're in Latin, and they wouldn't even read it, barely. And then they're like, no, we want the Bible. And then, like, it was illegal
mm-hmm.
to print English Bibles. I was like, this is so cool. But then it's, like... It was so ingrained with, like, the king at that time and then mm-hmm. the queen. And I'm like, everything is just connected.
Wow.
So I might just go into...
Yeah, when I was doing my obsession. Research for this, I stumbled across the whole, like, King James Bible
mm-hmm.
thing. And
mm-hmm.
I was thinking about the conversation that we had last night in the dining room,
yeah.
in the living room of our apartment.
Yeah.
And I was like, bruh, that's crazy. Because there's, like... That's, like, a whole other podcast. Which, mm-hmm. honestly, we should do. We should do a Creeds of the Church podcast. That would be great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But anyways, like, I think I'm just gonna, I might go into a slight obsession era where I'm just like, Shakespeare and the Renaissance.
No,
and
me too.
Reformation. And
me too. I'm in my Reformation obsession era right now, because that's literally what I'm writing my paper on.
I thought you were writing your paper on...
Jane Eyre, but how it relates to the Westminster Creed and Martin Jane Luther.
Oh, lit.
Wow.
So...
Can I read that when you're done?
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
actually very interesting to read.
Wait, have you read Jane Eyre?
Yeah.
I've also read Jane Eyre.
Really?
Grace,
we should have done Jane Eyre.
Grace Kling.
We are doing a podcast with Grace Kling on yeah. Jane Eyre.
Yeah.
Love. I can't wait to listen.
Yeah. She hates the book, apparently.
She hates the book.
But I just think that it's because Mr. Rochester is blind by the end.
Is blonde?
Blind.
Oh.
He's blind. I was blind, but now I see.
I was lost, but now I'm found. That was such a bad
bathe accident. In his blood.
Bathe in his blood.
I'm bathing his Yuck. Blood.
Okay, no, but Hannah, you were saying we do this last part of the podcast.
No, yeah, but I'm saying that's my takeaway from this, is that I...
You're obsessed with...
Yeah, I might be on the brink.
Of a 17th century obsession?
Because I also finished The Last Minor Prophet. That I read,
brother.
So that obsession is, like, closed.
Oh, yeah.
Well, it's never closed. It's always in my heart.
I love your Minor Prophet obsession.
So. It will always be in my heart.
Yeah.
But I think I'm just due for a new, something new. So, anyways, that's mm-hmm. my takeaway from this podcast, because you guys were so insightful. I loved listening to you guys. Thanks for coming.
Listening to you. Yeah.
So, what are your guys' takeaways?
Bryn, do you have one?
I mean, probably that I should read King Lear. but I think, yeah, it is very insightful. I think I even, as I was talking, made some new, like, revelations or formed some new opinions, I guess, about male characters in Shakespeare. Because there is a kind of cynicism as a woman, and you're reading all these plays and you're like, oh,
yeah. Oh,
women are silly and nagging, and you know, they're either foolishly in love with a man, mm. or they're an old hag yeah. in my old hag era.
In your spinster.
But either
eye.
Way, their life revolves around a male character.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
And, you know, there is a cynicism that comes with that after trying to, you know, find a way to relate to these characters. But yeah, I think not a new sympathy, but just a new angle, mm. I think.
It's good.
And especially the age-old debate of the tragic hero.
Right.
I think there's just so much to talk about that I could talk about for hours, just about, like, how do we define a hero? And are these qualities set in stone?
Mm.
Are any of them, are there any exceptions?
Mm.
I mean, that, again, goes way back to the Greeks. And also yeah. you can form your own opinions. You don't have to listen to the Greeks. Some of them didn't even like theater. Do you know Plato hated theater?
What?
Really?
Yeah.
Wait, what?
Yeah.
Wait, what?
He was a hater.
Excuse me?
Yeah.
That's crazy. I have notes. I had no idea.
Emily loves Plato.
We can talk about
I
it.
I love Plato. I have had a 3-year obsession with Symposium.
Mm-hmm.
That was our first podcast. It was on Symposium.
Yeah.
Wow, I can't wait to listen. Sorry, I didn't listen to the first one.
Fake.
I'm so sorry.
Also, like, Phaedo. Also, yeah, just, like, yeah.
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 But, again, yeah. So I think my takeaway is just kind of looking more at the nuance and the humanity of character. Because I think so much it's like, oh. Shakespeare characters.
They don't include women.
Right. And there's like, it's very, you know, cut and dry, black and white, but there's so much nuance. And of course, there has to be because they're well written characters and you have to like give him some credit. But yeah. And I think my, yeah, takeaway, just kind of a new lens. Love talking to you guys about it instead of just like in a theater classroom and people trying to sound.
Smart.
Like I sound like trying to sound like they know anything about
the
form.
Yeah.
I mean that's so intuitive, Brit.
Yeah.
Insightful. I keep saying intuitive, insightful.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what something I like about the format of this podcast is because it's about like someone who's read something, someone who hasn't read something, we could be like, "Oh, I didn't know about that." And it's not like we're like, "Oh, we can learn more."
No, absolutely.
Always, which is great. That's the great thing about life. We get to learn for the rest of our lives.
No, okay.
So good.
Speaking and get new lenses.
Get new lenses.
About characters. That's so exciting, Bryn. That's a great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's Sorry. Awesome.
I just really enjoyed that.
Yeah. Aww. That was sweet.
Thank you so much. It was a great time.
This was a good time. Keep your eyes peeled for our.
We say that all the time now because
eyes peeled.
Because one time I accidentally said that.
Yeah,
keep your eyes peeled.
Keep your eyes and your ears peeled.
Your ears unwaxed.
Clean out your ears.
Stop stopping up your ears.
Yeah. Grab some Q-tips and a cotton ball.
You know, one time
and that candle.
One time I went to the health center because I thought I got a Q-tip stuck in my ear.
Hannah, what?
Yep.
And on that.
And on that note.
Oh, we'll never find out if it was.
And on that note.
You'll find out at the Rich Kids Show March 30th.
March 30th.
Come to the Rich Kids Show at March 30th. This episode was sponsored by Rich Kids Comedy Club.
And also the Moby Dick podcast.
And also the Moby Dick podcast. And Oat Milk Lattes.
Love ya.
Love ya.
Bye. Love ya.
Bye.
Bye.
Pretentia is a production of KBR The Torch at Biola University, hosted by Emily Coffey, co-hosted by Hannah Federa, and produced by Michael Fawcett.